Hey, welcome to the Stop Self-Sabotage System. I'm your head coach, Howard Jacobson, and in these three audios, we're going to show you exactly how to stop self-sabotage when you begin some early stage habit change. We're going to look at the three big mistakes people make, and we're going to show you three tactics or strategies for overcoming or preventing each one of them. So that intro music, that's me on the harmonica, on the mouth harp, part of my band, the Roosevelt String Band, and that was a rendition of Muddy Waters, Rolling and Tumbling. And it's an old blues song. It goes back many, many generations with many, many different iterations and lyrics and melodies. But basically, it's about a guy who can't get his life in order because he is at the mercy of his cravings and addictions. And he obviously didn't know the strategies that we're going to go over in the Stop Self-Sabotage System, but when you're done, you will, and so you can stop all of your rolling and tumbling. All right, so let's get started. So the first thing to realize is that stopping self-sabotage is the key to any sustainable lifestyle or behavior or habit change, because if it weren't for self-sabotage, this would all be easy. We would just decide, okay, today I'm going to eat clean from now on, and we would just do it. We would decide, I'm going to work out 30 minutes a day, five times a week, and we would just do it. And the fact that we don't often largely comes from not external circumstances getting in our way, stopping us, preventing us from reaching these goals. It's our own minds, our own thoughts, our own behaviors, our own habits that drag us back down. But I haven't talked a ton about early stage self-sabotage, the self-sabotage that happens almost at the beginning of a change journey. And I think that's largely because the kind of questions I get from people are about the later stages. People, when they get to me, when they find my work, are usually far along. They've been struggling for years sometimes, backsliding, going forward, making progress, falling off the wagon, and they tend to be very, very frustrated, but they have different sets of problems than people who maybe are just starting out, who are in the early stages of considering and adopting a change. Now, I know there's a model, John Prochaska's trans-theoretical model, that really puts a lot of stock in the idea of what stage of change you're in. Are you at pre-contemplation or contemplation or action or maintenance? And I think there's some value in thinking about it that way, but I think also that kind of thinking can get in our way. And we can assign a label to ourselves that holds us back from taking action now because we're, quote, pre-contemplative. And in my experience, people can go from pre-contemplative to active in a hot second. Something has to trigger them, has to flip a switch in their brain, and they don't necessarily have to follow this playbook. But that said, the beginning is an important part of the journey. For one thing, it's the only part of the journey that everyone who takes the journey goes on. Because if you stop right after the beginning, you never get to the middle and the end game. So everyone starts at the beginning, whether you're trying to change your eating or exercise or starting to meditate or doing something like I do, pouring a bucket of cold water over your head every single morning, whatever it is that you think is good for you and you want to be doing, and there's this conflict between your desires and your behaviors. So that's what we're going to be focusing on in these Healthy Habit Huddles for July. And I'm going to be recording all three of them, and you get them if you are a paying client, if you've paid me money for anything, for the Big Change program, for private coaching, to be a member of the Tribe of Well. You get it if you are a patron of Plant Yourself, of the podcast and the other media that I share with the world, and you can get access to all these Healthy Habit Huddles for just any amount of contribution, even as low as $1 a month. The goal here is not to make a killing on it, but just to help people who need just that little bit of extra incentive to pay for something that they get for free anyway. You know how that is with the public radio fund drives or other things or museums. where you can get the same thing for free or pay. So they often have little bonuses, little extras. And so I'm making these huddles available without attempting to restrict it to people with loads of cash. But if you have $12 a year, you can have access to these huddles by going to patreon.com/plantyourself and becoming a subscriber and a patron of the show and of my work. So let's get started. And we're going to get started with an embarrassing story. So one morning, actually several decades ago now, I was probably in my late 20s, early 30s, I got up really early, was in a rush, skipped breakfast, and I can't remember where I had to go, probably off to work on some weekend job, and I stumbled to my car in the driveway, and, how you can sort of autopilot that, so get in the car, close the door, put on the seatbelt, step on the brake, put the key in the ignition, put the car in reverse, ease off the brakes, and roll out of the driveway, you know, like I have done, you know, thousands of times already in my life. But this time, after about moving 3.5 feet, I slammed to a halt and was thrown back against the seat, and I heard crunching, and I was really confused. My heart was pounding, physics weren't working the way they should have worked. And so now I was wide awake and I turned around to see what had happened. What had I hit? And I'm embarrassed to say I had driven into our other car, which had been parked right behind the one I was driving in my single lane driveway. I just got into the wrong car. I got into the car that was farthest away from the road instead of the one that was next to the road. And I didn't even look. I didn't notice. And I just had a little collision. And I'm sure the insurance company reps had a lot of laughs that day as I explained how both of my cars had experienced collision damage on the very same day. So I haven't engaged in that level of driving cluelessness since then. But in other areas of my life, I've noticed that I'm still an expert in getting in my own way as I begin a journey. And I've noticed that my clients and students often experience and will see create predictable obstacles as they ramp up their own journeys to wellness. Their early stage on-ramps can often be the place where they get stuck the most, where they have these needless collisions with their own habits, with their own thoughts, with their own mindsets. So in this three-part series of huddles, I'm going to share three of the most common second cars in the driveway, and I'm going to explain how to navigate lifestyle and diet change so you don't crash before you even get moving. So today we're going to look at the first second car in the driveway, second car in the driveway number one, and that is insistence on perfection. So I'm going to begin with an old joke I heard. So Tom is sitting on the porch next to his dog, Jake. Jake's lying on the porch, howling like crazy. You're welcome for the sound effects. And so his neighbor Edna comes by and says, what's the matter with Jake? And Tom says, oh, Jake's sitting on a rusty nail. Edna's confused. Well, why don't he just get up? Tom explains, because it don't hurt enough yet. So most of us have a lot of issues in our lives that simply don't hurt enough yet. So, for example, I am annoyed at the broken bathroom fan in the guest bathroom. You know, people are annoyed about weighing an extra 15 pounds or 20 pounds or 30 or 40 or 50 or 115 pounds of fat. We might get annoyed at slow cashiers, unhelpful call center reps. You know, and we can complain about them and ruminate about them and obsess about them with regularity, but we generally live with these problems rather than spending energy and other resources trying to solve them. And so when do the problems become those that we want to solve? When does Jake get up? And the answer is the problems rise to the level of enough is enough only in two situations. One is when they tip past some threshold, like you get on the scale and it says 300 pounds. Or when some event or outcome makes it clear that the status quo is completely unacceptable. So, for example, you have a house guest with really bad diarrhea in your guest bathroom and the fan doesn't work. Right? That's an event. Or an outcome, like you haven't gotten that $30 taken off your monthly cable bill and you're now outraged enough to do something about poor customer service from your cable provider. So in other words, you get a feedback. Either it's internal based on exceeding some internal standard of this ain't bad enough yet, this don't hurt enough yet, or the world smacks you somehow. And so now the pain of doing nothing is perceived as greater than the pain of doing something, or the annoyance, or the energy, or the cost or commitment of doing something. So in other words, we all delay taking action until it suddenly hurts enough. And at that point, we feel the urgency. And at that point, we want to solve the problem now and completely and forever. In other words, we want to go from sucky to perfection in a hot second. I know a lot about this from my previous life. In case you don't know, I spent 15 years doing digital marketing, and my main focus was an advertising program called Google AdWords. And if you're not familiar with Google AdWords, I'm sure you're familiar with Google and Google as a search engine. And when people search on Google, they often see paid listings, ads that companies run on the keywords that they're searching. And those are what are called AdWords. So I worked, I had an agency, I was a consultant, I ran lots of campaigns. And the main thing that I worked on and taught my clients and students was to focus on this sense of urgency. That by the time people were doing a search, they were already in that kind of hurts enough mode. And so unlike lots of other forms of marketing, you didn't really have to ramp up and make people worried and sick and upset and fearful. You didn't have to stoke their emotions so much. They were already coming in on the fuel of their negative emotion, on their fuel of enough is enough. And therefore, those people tended to be extremely vulnerable to big promises, to sort of magical solutions. You know, so someone comes in and they're looking to lose weight, they're going to be interested in the solution that says lose 30 pounds in 3 days by eating all of your favorite foods, right? So there's an irrationality to our mindset when we reach that past that tipping point of enough is enough and start getting ready to take action. So I want to be clear that in and of itself, aiming for perfection isn't a problem at all. In fact, it's typically admirable. You know, can you imagine like an NBA player in the playoffs going up to the free throw line after getting fouled and not trying to swish the ball through the basket? You know, if they said, "Well, I'll just get it anywhere near the basket. If it hits the rim and bounces out, that's fine. If it bounces off the backboard, you know, kind of anywhere is okay." Of course, that's not the right attitude. The problem isn't that we are chasing perfection and that we prefer perfection and we do a lot of work to achieve perfection. The problem comes when we make instant perfection, the only acceptable standard. Right, I'm going to say that again. The problem comes when we make immediate, instant perfection the only acceptable standard. So not only are we aiming for perfection, we are unwilling to do things that might take time, that might get us to perfection over time, because we're so stoked. We've got the sense of urgency around us. And so the problem with that is that we can't achieve immediate perfection most of the time. Immediate perfection is simply unattainable. And so if that's what we're going for, and that's the only thing we're going for, we're going to come up against a bunch of very predictable obstacles. And especially when it comes to things like lifestyle and diet, we've been conditioned for years and often decades to behave in certain ways. And none of those factors go away when we suddenly get off the rusty nail and muster the will to change. Some of these factors are our biological hardwiring, that humans seek out these hyperpalatable foods, that we try to avoid pain of any kind or discomfort of any kind, and that we try to avoid any sort of strenuous exertion. Those are biologically hardwired, and if our ancestors hadn't passed those on to us, we wouldn't be here, because no one could survive in the ancestral environment without a predilection for remembering where hyperpalatable foods are and wanting them again and again. If we didn't have a predilection for avoiding the type of discomfort that might lead to life-threatening danger, and if we just ran around willy-nilly wasting our energy so we didn't have energy when we needed it for the hunt or the courtship or the defense or whatever else we needed to do. So we've got this biological hardwiring that is simply not going to go away just because we suddenly have a desire to change our behavior. On top of our biological hardwire, we have all of our own tastes and preferences. And they're on a substrate. They're on the foundation of hardwiring that humans are able and tend to develop their own taste preferences. But they're all unique to us. And whatever culture you grow up in, whatever you eat as a kid, you're going to prefer that. So it's very sort of experientially determined, the types of things that we want to eat. If you've spent your whole life enjoying pepperoni pizza and suddenly you're given a salad or beans and rice, you may not be able to achieve perfection instantly because of the elastic, clingy nature of the tastes and preferences that you already have. And you're going to need a lot of strategies over time to deal with those. So those are a couple of internal obstacles to change. We also have external ones, like our immediate environments. Look at your home, look at your kitchen. You know, the day you decide to change, your kitchen didn't magically transform itself into a whole food, plant-based paradise. If you woke up one morning and decided that you want to start working out, your loungewear didn't suddenly turn into activewear. The Barca lounger didn't turn into a treadmill, and your pumps didn't suddenly turn into cross training shoes. In addition to our physical environment, we also have default systems that are embedded on top of that environment. In other words, we have a default system for shopping that, without thinking about it, you'll make a certain list with a certain bunch of items in it. You'll get into a certain vehicle, drive to a certain location, go up and down the aisles in a certain order, pick up certain things, and you know, by default, I mean, you don't have to put conscious thought into it. We have default systems for cooking. We have default systems for cleaning, for storing the food. We have default systems for relaxing after work, for, you know, going to movies, for calling friends. That, you know, whenever we've spent enough time in a particular environment, we develop these defaults. And the default systems are very often, in fact, they're always, default systems are always supporting the status quo. So if you're unhappy with the status quo, you can't suddenly snap your fingers and magically change it until you've addressed all of the systems and you've changed the system so that the systems produce the outcomes and results that you want. Okay, so another external obstacle to change is our social networks, from family, people we live with, to neighbors, friends, coworkers, going out farther, acquaintances, going out farther, social media networks. And people are often very, very powerful cues for our behavior. If you're going to, you know, if you've gone out with a bunch of people and every time you've gone out with them, you've had three margaritas and a bucket of buffalo wings, and you like those people and you don't want to lose them as friends, when you go out with them, you're going to be significantly tempted to keep doing what you've been doing with them, to behave in the ways that they've come to expect from you, and you're not going to want to rock the boat. And one level above that is our consumer culture, driven by advertising, driven by other people trying to make money off of our decisions. And, you know, you ride up and down the road and you see billboards and you watch commercials everywhere you go that are trying to trigger our addictions. And there are many more, but you can just, even that short list gives us a real sense of what are the factors that are imposed upon us or that we have imposed upon ourselves and conditioned ourselves so that if we just want to make a behavioral change, an outcome change, that's sort of a tip of the iceberg thing, and we can see that the base of the iceberg, the hidden thing, all these factors have to change as well. And it's really impossible to change them all in one fell swoop. So that thinking that we can overcome all these obstacles to change in a single moment of intense meditation is really insanity. And it's an invitation to fail bigly. But it doesn't stop us from trying, right? So we try to bite off more than we can chew. We'll split our focus on too many fronts at once. Okay, so tomorrow I'm going to eat 3 salads, work out for 1.5 hours, meditate for 45 minutes, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's like, you know, a military campaign where we're trying to fight all the enemy fronts at once instead of getting traction in one area and then using that as a beachhead to then attack some other domain. And so because we've got this insistence on perfection, on instant and complete perfection, we will exhaust ourselves and we will stress ourselves out. And guess what happens when we stress ourselves out? When we are stressed, two things happen. One is our bodies try to conserve energy. And one way to do that is to return to the default. Anything that's not the default requires inputs. So the default state is our, quote, natural state, at least at our current level of existence. So that when we're stressed out, our bodies naturally say, okay, let me think, the easiest thing to do here is to eat the chocolate bar. It's much less confusing than a salad. And the second thing that we do when we stress ourselves out is it's not a good feeling. We suffer. And so when we suffer, when we have unwanted, unpleasant, uncomfortable feelings, we want to get rid of them. And the best way we know how to get rid of them is by self-soothing and self-medicating with the very bad habits that we're trying to get rid of, with food, with drink, with vegging out on the couch and binge watching, all the sorts of things that have gotten us to the place we don't want to be are the very behaviors that we're going to flee to in an attempt to make ourselves feel better, feel less bad in the moment. So let's talk about the different ways that we can combat this initial impulse toward perfection. And there are 3 of them that we're going to cover in this huddle. Number 1 is simply to recognize that tendency. Recognize when our desire to get it right takes on a fairly intense urgency and starts feeling unreasonable. Now, as I said, wanting to achieve perfection itself isn't the problem. It's when getting caught up in perfectionism causes us to overcommit and burn out. That's when we're in trouble. So the first thing to do is to simply notice the tendency within yourself. And the best way to do that is to look backwards. So does this sound familiar? In the past, where have you gone all in and then found your commitment wavering after a week or a month? That's a pretty good indication that you are aiming for perfectionism. So let me give you some examples from maybe my own life. So have you ever wanted to start exercising? And the first thing you did was you bought all the gear and all the clothes and you rearranged your living room for the stationary bike or the treadmill. You put in 1 hour a day for a couple of weeks and then 2 months later found yourself with this expensive towel rack. So that's a really good indication that your tendency, your impulse towards perfection, your insistence on perfection, on doing everything right away, was unsustainable and led to burnout. In the domain of food, have you ever had one of those enough is enough moments and suddenly went through your kitchen, threw out all your junk food, went shopping, and filled your fridge with enough produce and herbal tonics to keep Gwyneth Paltrow in smoothies for a year. And then a few days later, you started tossing the rotten veggies into trash because either you didn't know how to prepare them or you cooked them into some stew and you had a little bit of it. It wasn't very good. And you just put the lid back on and put it in the back of the fridge until it started growing sort of technical or mold. So, and think of other examples in your own past that indicate that you were suffering from an insistence on perfection. And bring yourself back to that time and see if you can feel the feeling in your body. What did it feel like? What does it feel like now, as you recall it, to want to solve it all at once right now? To not be willing to take your time, to not be willing to be patient, to be in this sort of binary mode of it's either terrible or it has to be perfect. And just get a sense of what that feeling is in your body in terms of literally physical sensations, because you'll have them. It might be a tightness across the sternum or the chest or the belly. It might be dry mouth. It might be a feeling of almost shaking, like sort of impatience to get up and do anything. And also notice what the mood is like in your body, this mood of, I've got to make it all better right now, and there's no time to wait, to waste, to consider. I've just got to jump right in, a kind of fool's rush in feeling in your body. And so the first step is to recognize that tendency, and let's do it historically by taking some time to think back on times in your past where this was your mode of operation. So you can pause the recording right now and take a few minutes to sit and recall some of those times, bring yourself back into those times, or maybe you're feeling it right now. Maybe you're trying to make a change right now and you've got this enough is enough feeling. You just feel like you've just leapt off the rusty nail and you've got to solve everything in this moment. So take some time, whether it's 1 minute or 5 or 10, to just sort of sit with this feeling so that when it comes up, you'll recognize it for what it is. Okay, are you back? Cool. So let's talk about the second strategy to overcome an insistence on perfection. And that is set mini goals. Here's the thing. Perfectionism thrives on a binary mindset. And binary means, you know, 0 or 1. 0, things are total crap now. And 1, they have to be marvelous. There's no in-between. There's no on-ramp. There's no pathway to success. It's either beam me up, Scotty, or nothing. And this would be fine if real life worked that way, but we know real life works differently. And real life works in terms of progress toward our goals in steps. And progress can take two different flavors. One, it could be glacial. These really small, almost imperceptible improvements, the way a glacier moves across the landscape just a couple of meters per year. So even if you're staring at it, you wouldn't notice it. You know, glacial is also the way our hair grows, or the way our garden grows, or the way we age over time, that you really have to time-lapse in order to see change. But nevertheless, seeds turn into plants. We grow older. Our hair grows too long and we have to get it cut or shave. And that's the way the world operates most of the time, is glacially. The other natural model for change is tectonic, which is to say a little earthquake, that the plates shift. It's not that everything's different, but something significant and fundamental has changed, and that allows everything on top of it to settle in a different way. So a bigger kind of shift. But these are the two ways in the natural world that progress happens. It's either glacial or tectonic, and we do well to mimic that in our everyday lives. And we can mimic it with two different tools. One is milestones, and the other are tiny habits. So let's take advantage of reality by accommodating and planning for milestones along the way. So let's say your goal is to exercise hard an hour a day, 6 days a week. But right now, your fiercest exertion is when you operate the manual height adjustment on your minivan seat. Then let's plan out a bunch of mini goals along the way. So maybe the first goal is to walk a mile. Maybe another goal is to walk a mile in 20 minutes. Maybe it's to do 3 times a week, a 20-minute mile. Maybe then finding a local yoga class and trying to stay active for an entire hour-long workout by increasing the number of minutes before you lay down in Shavasana by 5 minutes every week. So maybe the first week you can only do 20 minutes, and then you spend the last 40 on your back recovering. Then after a couple of weeks, you're down to 35 minutes and 30 and 20 and 15, and then you're only resting for 5. And then finally, you're doing the whole class, and you're getting into the resting pose at the same time as everybody else when the teacher says. Maybe you want to do 10,000 steps a day, and now you're doing only 400. So maybe add 2% to your daily steps each day until you reach your goal number, even if it takes a couple of years. And that 2%, of course, is arbitrary. And once you realize you can add 2%, you might start adding 5% and 10%. And you'll find that simply the act of breaking these big goals, these big milestones into mini goals, into mini milestones, until you reach your goal number is actually the fastest way to get there. It's paradoxical. You'd think that running would get you there faster, but here's a case of tortoise and hare, that purposely going slow and setting these mini goals and achieving them in time is actually the quickest way to achieve your ultimate goals. So you get the idea. You want to break these ultimate goals into small steps, and really the smaller the better, and hold yourself accountable for achieving the possible rather than the unrealistically heroic. And along with those milestones go tiny habits, so the behaviors that you do every single day. And I've talked on these huddles a lot about B.J. Fogg's model, his behavioral model, and his idea of tiny habits. The idea is if you want to just start doing push-ups and you find yourself never doing push-ups, then don't set yourself a goal of doing 20 push-ups because you're not doing it. It's like trying to plant a tree in a tiny little pot. The pot isn't big enough to accommodate the full tree. Your schedule, your mindset, your habits, your systems aren't ready to accommodate the full thing. But what if you say your goal is do one push-up, and one push-up is a success? And then so you're waiting for the water to get hot for your shower, and you go and you do one push-up. And then you're down on the ground, and you can get up, and you can say, good, I've done my one push-up. And you can do that for a while. And after a while, you're down on the ground, you went to all that trouble, you might as well just do 2 push-ups. And eventually you'll do 3 because it's not that big a deal, but your goal is always one push-up. And so B.J. Fogg's metaphor there is that tiny habit is like a seed, and if you plant it in the right place and care for it, then it's going to grow to its natural shape. The carrot seed will grow into a carrot plant. The acorn will grow into an oak tree. That it will achieve the right magnitude of a habit over time. So that's the second thing. Not only for milestones, but set mini goals according to the behaviors themselves. So implement these tiny habits and allow them to grow over time. So here's another good place to pause and think about your mini goals, your milestones, and the tiny habits that you're going to implement to achieve those milestones. So let's keep it simple for now and just come up with one milestone and come up with one tiny habit. So to reach a milestone, it's helpful to start to think about what does perfection really look like? So we've talked about this insistence on perfection, but we haven't really taken time to define it for yourself. So take a few moments and think about what does perfection actually look like? If you could wave a magic wand and have everything exactly how you want it and have your behaviors exactly as you want them, what would your life look like? So pause the recording, take a few seconds now to imagine that. And once you have that vision of perfection, take a few moments to think about what's the first step on that path. What's the first milestone, mini goal that would tell you you're on your road to that ultimate perfection? And now, take a few moments to identify one behavior, one habit, tiny habit, a little thing that you can add to your life that will help you achieve that first milestone. Okay, so we've got two things. We've got recognize the tendency to perfection, set mini goals so that if we still have this tendency to perfection, we can try to be perfect towards a much smaller, more manageable goal rather than trying to leap all the way across the chasm to make an impossible leap to ultimate perfection. And the third one here is really, really important from a brain perspective, and that is to celebrate small wins. So in addition to setting these mini goals, it's crucial to reward your brain by celebrating your progress every time you achieve one of them. And the nice thing about all these mini goals is that you get a hit of perfection juice each time you reach one. And in fact, you can get that hit simply from making progress toward it by doing a little better this week than last week. You can get a hit of perfection juice coursing through your brain, rewarding you for your activity, for getting down and doing a single push-up, for walking up a single flight of stairs instead of taking the elevator, that all of these tiny habits and mini goals are opportunities for you to reinforce a new habit loop. So habit loops are really interesting. And if you think about how any of your bad habits were formed, they were formed in a single way, that there was some sort of trigger in your environment or in your thoughts. So maybe you saw a piece of cake. And then the trigger led to a behavior on your part. And this is the very first time you didn't know what would happen, but you ate the cake. And then you had a feeling, you got a reward. Your brain released dopamine and said, oh, this is good stuff. And that created the beginning of a loop. So you want that reward again. So the next time you see the trigger, you're going to engage in the same behavior to get that same reward. And that's how we get addicted to food, to drugs, to alcohol, to cigarettes, to anger, to depression, to any of our default states that give us some relief in the moment, but long-term lead to problems. So we can hijack that loop system by rewarding ourselves, celebrating all of our tiny wins, which then in the same way as we developed all these bad habits, our brains become neuroadapted to look for opportunities to move toward these mini goals and engage in these tiny positive habits and move us on our path towards that ultimate perfection that we're so dearly wanting. So you think like a casino operator here. You don't get people addicted to the slots just by having one person a year win this extremely improbable, gargantuan payout. No, you get people addicted to slot machines by dripping little random wins along the way. You never know when you're going to win something. Sometimes it's just one coin back. Sometimes it's nothing. Sometimes it's three coins. Sometimes it's a tiny little jackpot of 20. Sometimes it's reasonably sized. Even though that big one is still incredibly unlikely and statistically improbable, that your brain, when you get these little wins along the way, gets addicted to the chase. Because our brains have evolved to respond really powerfully to pretty much any degree of positive reinforcement. And it's a good thing, too, because that's how courtship can lead to procreation. And that's how a single bite of chocolate cake can lead to a lifelong obsession with chocolate, theobroma, the food of the gods. So instead of having your perfection-craving mind sabotage you by urging you to leap across this behavioral chasm that's simply too wide, you can give it constant feedback of, we're on the right track, we're doing good. And then your mind becomes an ally to your transformation and not an obstacle or an enemy to be overcome. So let's finish up this huddle by having you practice celebrating a small win. So think about something that you did right today. And I know if you're a perfectionist, you're looking for, you know, moonshots, amazing, amazing things. So let's lower our sights a little bit. Did you get up this morning? Good job. Did you brush your teeth? Did you floss? Did you make breakfast? Did you clean the kitchen? Whatever you did, you didn't have to do. You could have left it undone. Right? So even if you've had a terrible morning, you're still listening to this. So you put this on, or someone else put it on for you, and you didn't turn it off, and you're paying attention to my words right now. So let's take a few seconds. As the music plays, it'll be, your cue to pause. And think about one or more small wins that you've achieved today and celebrate them. And you can celebrate them simply by smiling and nodding your head and feeling a little bit of accomplishment at them. You can say something to yourself like, good job, or oh yeah, or right on, or you're a rock star. You could do a little happy dance. You could include a gesture, a fist in the air, a high five to yourself, a thumbs up, peace sign. You could do a little Elaine dance of stirring the pot from Seinfeld. Whatever tells you and your brain that you've done good. So take a few seconds now, think about a couple of those small wins, and congratulate yourself and celebrate them. All right, good job. So I hope that you actually did pause during those little musical interludes and do the exercise and don't just listen to them. Now, of course, if you're listening in your car, you know, or while operating heavy machinery, then don't close your eyes and do it now, but come back to this. And I think it starts around minute 22 or so. We get into these exercises and really take the time and maybe, you know, close your eyes, find some privacy, find some space, and get out a journal or open up a file on your computer and take this stuff seriously, because this is probably the biggest car in the driveway that stops people as they begin some journeys. They've got this urgency. They've been triggered into a state of sort of panic, a state of things are terrible and they're not okay and they can never be okay again until this thing is fixed. And it leads to this craving, grasping, sort of negative, excited state in which we're frenzied and we're very susceptible to marketing from other people selling us magical things that are too good to be true. And then we market magical things that are too good to be true to ourselves, and we end up in a worse place than we even started, because now not only have we failed and we haven't achieved our goals, but we've gotten reinforcement that there's something wrong with us and we can't do it. So now we have less hope than before and more opportunities and more excuses to go back to our old behaviors. So next week, we're going to talk about the second car in the driveway. And the following week, we're going to talk about the third car in the driveway. For now, I hope this has been useful. And again, do the exercises. Don't just dial this stuff in, but really, really go for it. Roll up your sleeves. This is the path to success, to mastery, to the ultimate perfection that you seek. It's not a leap. It is a journey of many, many steps. And many of those steps will include stumbles. And there's always another step. There's always picking ourselves up, taking another step, taking it seriously, not looking for the shortcut, but simply doing the work. Because ultimately, the ultimate goal, the perfection that we seek, when we get there, we'll realize, well, there's a lot more to do. There's a lot more perfection to attain. And maybe this isn't making me as happy as I thought it would. So if we're not learning and growing from the journey, then there's really no point. So here's to growing from the journey. Here's to overcoming our insistence on perfection by recognizing the tendency, setting mini goals of mini milestones and tiny habits, and then celebrating every small win along the way. All right, I'll see you back here next time. As always, be well, my friends.